God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Jonah chapter 2, where we will resume with verse 3. All right, having assembled together, as is the first stage and gap for the positive believer, the command from Giant James is to lay aside everything that remains of filthiness and everything that remains of wickedness, which is essentially a command to isolate the sin nature. This is either accomplished, of course, through avoiding sin, but in the case of laying it aside, it is accomplished through the rebound technique. This is what God has provided as the rapid recovery system, so that when believers sin, and we all sin, we can immediately be restored to fellowship upon recognition of that sin and confession of the same to God. Beyond all that, he urges those who listen to listen with humility, to humble themselves under the mighty hand of God, put aside anger and other factors that are not conducive to the intake of doctrine nor to the application of it, and to humble themselves and take in the word which is able to deliver their souls. This is what we seek for, is deliverance from our own personal stupidity, deliverance from the STA, which we know will never be perfect in this life, and deliverance from loss at the Bema Seat. So with that all before us, let us prepare ourselves in the usual fashion. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity we have once again to assemble together, recognizing that it is through the teaching of your word that believers are built up in the faith, that we come to understand the principles of who you are, what you want, and where your plan is heading. We thank you for all the enlightenment that you do provide, and we thank you for the living grace that allows us to live in the devil's world and to continue to pursue your plan in an unhindered fashion. We thank you for the relative freedom that we enjoy in this country so that we can assemble together and take in the word of God without fear. We pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will bless our thinking and continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, before we begin, one of the things I was looking for, had been researching and found, was one of the principal objections, of course, to the book of Jonah, is that it would be impossible for a man to be swallowed by a fish and to be able to live, and certainly not for a period of 3 days, but as we have pointed out, that 3 days and three nights need not encompass a full 72-hour period, but could literally have been as short as 26 hours. So we don't know exactly how long. I don't think Jonah had a watch with him. I doubt seriously that he knew even what time it was when he was cast off the ship. Given the nature of the storm and all of that, there would have been no way for, you know, deducing the absolute correct time. So I found this interesting article here on the Whaling Star of the East, which was in the vicinity of the Falkland Islands, searching for whales, which were very scarce. One morning, the lookout sighted a whale about 3 miles away on the starboard quarter. Two boats were manned, and in a short time, one of the boats was near enough to enable the harpooner to send a spear into the whale, which proved to be an exceedingly large one. With the shaft in his side, the animal sounded and then sped away, dragging the boat after him with terrible speed. He swam straight away about 5 miles, and then he turned and came back almost directly towards the spot where he had been harpooned. The second boat waited for him. When but a short distance from it, he rose to the surface. As soon as his back showed above the surface of the water, the harpooner in the second boat drove another spear into him. The pain apparently crazed the whale, for it threshed about fearfully, as it feared the boats would be swamped, the boats would be swamped and the crews drowned. Finally, the whale swam away, dragging the two boats after him. He went about 3 miles and sounded or sank, and as his whereabouts could not be exactly told. The lines to the harpooners were slack, and the harpooners slowly began to draw them back and coil them in the tubes. As soon as they were taut, the whale arose to the surface and beat about with its tail in the maddest of fashions. The boats attempted to get beyond the reach of the animal, which was apparently in its death agonies. and one of them succeeded, but the other was less fortunate. The whale struck it with his nose and upset it. The men were thrown into the water, and before the crew of the other boat could pick them up, one man drowned, and James Bartley had disappeared. But when the whale became quiet from exhaustion, the waters were searched for Bartley, and he could not be found. And under the impression that he had been struck by the whale's tail and sunk to the bottom, the survivors rowed back to the ship. The whale was dead, and in a few hours the great body was lying on the ship's side, and the men were busy with axes and spades cutting through the flesh to secure the fat. They worked all day and part of the night, and they resumed operations the next noon and were soon down to the stomach, which was to be hoisted to the deck. The workmen were startled when, laboring to clear it and fasten the chain about it, discovered something doubled up in it, giving spasmodic signs of life. The vast pouch was hoisted to the deck and cut open, and inside was the missing sailor, doubled up and unconscious. He was laid out on the deck and treated to a bath of seawater, which soon revived him, but his mind was not clear. And he was placed in the captain's quarters, where he remained for weeks, a raving lunatic. I guess it would have an effect on you. He was laid out. He was carefully treated by the captain and officers of the ship, and finally began to get possession of his senses. And at the end of the third week, he had finally recovered from the shock and resumed his duties. During the brief sojourn in the belly's whale, Bartley's skin, where it was exposed to the action of the gastric juices, underwent a striking change. His hands and feet were bleached to a deadly whiteness, and the skin was wrinkled, giving the man the appearance of having been parboiled. Bartley affirms that he would probably have lived inside the house of flesh until he starved, for he lost his senses through fright and not from lack of air. He says that he remembers the sensation of being lifted into the air by the nose of the whale and dropping into the water, and there was a frightful rushing sound which he believed to be the beating of the water by the whale's tail. And then he was encompassed by a fearful darkness, and he felt himself slipping along a smooth passage of some sort that seemed to move and carry him forward. This sensation lasted but an instant, and then he felt he had more room. He felt about him, and his hands came in contact with a yielding, slimy substance that seemed to shrink from his touch. It finally dawned upon him that he had been swallowed by a whale, and he was overcome by horror at the situation. He could breathe, but the heat was terrible. It was not of a scorching, stifling nature, but it seemed to draw out his vitality. He became very weak and grew sick at the stomach. He knew there was no hope of escape from his strange prison. Death stared him in the face, and he tried to look at it bravely, but the awful quiet, the fearful darkness, the horrible knowledge of the environments, and the terrible heat finally overcame him, and he must have fainted. For the next he remembered was being in the captain's cabin. Bartley is not a man of timid nature, but he says that it was many weeks before he could pass a night without having his sleep disturbed with harrowing signs of angry whales and the horrors of his fearful prison. The skin on the face and hands of Bartley has never recovered its natural appearance. It is yellow and wrinkled and looks like old parchment. The health of the man does not seem to have been affected by his terrible experience. He is in splendid spirits and apparently enjoys all the blessings of life that come his way. The whaling captains say they never remember a parallel case to this before. They say that it frequently happens that men are swallowed by whales, who become infuriated by the pain of harpoon and attack the boats, but have never known a man to go through the ordeal that Bartley did and came out alive. This story is first said to have appeared in October of 1892 in the English newspaper Great Yarmouth Mercury. It was then reprinted in other papers and has been cited by countless pastors from the pulpit ever since, in affirming the truth and the veracity of the story of Jonah, and was published in the 63 years of engineering, science, and social work, published in 24. So that all sounds like, there is some documentation that this could happen, however counterclaimed. It has been counterclaimed by skeptics that in 1906, an Anglican clergyman named Canon Williams wrote to Captain Killiam to verify the story, but received a letter from the captain's wife dated November 24, 1906, saying, "There is not one word of truth to the whole story. I was with my husband all the years he was on the Star of the East, and there was never a man lost overboard while my husband was here. The sailor has told you a great sea yarn." And so I'll send this out to you, but one of the things I put on the bottom is a disclaimer. I found it on the internet. It must be true. So, and you can imagine, of course, I know in the zeal to try to prove that the miraculous of the Bible could have happened, sometimes you just have to accept it by faith. There is no proof ever that I know of that any person has ever been swallowed by a whale and lived to tell about it. And there is no proof that even the fish that swallowed Jonah was a whale in the first place. We just simply know it was a great fish, and it's a generic term and all of that. There's no indication in the text or anywhere else that Jonah's skin was materially altered in order to give more credence to his message. And there's nothing said at all about when the inhabitants of Nineveh, as we're going to see, received the message, that they did so because Jonah looked weird. One of the things is, in the zeal to prove that the Bible is true, sometimes people go overboard. And this is an example of that, I think. When stories like this circulate around, are quoted by undiscerning pastors because they read it on the internet. And this is an affront to what sound teaching should be about. Sound teaching should be about verifiable facts that can be proven. And where they do not aren't verifiable facts that can be proven, for instance, that Jonah was swallowed by a fish, and survived the ordeal, the believer just simply has to accept it by faith. And there's no indication, again, from any of the rabbinic sources that this story was ever viewed as anything other than the truth, strict truth. Even though no one ever saw it, no one could verify it, but Jonah, literally, it is one man's word against the whole world that this actually occurred. And yet, by faith, we believe that it did. And so, again, people get overzealous to try to document things. Stick with the facts. It's easy to get carried away. And it's easy to get all wrapped up and wrapped around the axle about seeking to vindicate God's plan. You know, God's plan did just fine before you got here. It'll probably do fine after you're gone. We are not here as the lone defenders of the faith. Okay, well, just to show you that, I wanted to point that out because as I was doing research on this, I found that this has been quoted. This is, shall we call it a fish story, has been around for a while. In order to, quote, document that the story of Jonah is true. Well, I don't need any documentation, frankly, because the very fact that Jonah 1:1 there in the beginning starts out as, in the Hebrew text, as clearly historical narrative. It starts off with a wow consecutive and a cal imperfect, just as other historical narrative does, and there's nothing unusual or difficult or different about it in that sense. Okay, so back to where we were now, after a little break here. Back to Jonah, and as he is going to recount for us all the events that came to pass, or the ones that are germane to his story at any rate, not all of them, but the ones that are germane to his story that came to pass following his expulsion from the boat. And again, there's no indication in chapter 1, although many people see Jonah recovering spiritually in chapter 1. Some see his recovery in chapter 2. I never see a recovery in Jonah at all. Again, during this 2 month or so period of his life, Jonah lets his STA essentially run rampant in this one area. And Jonah is a miserable believer because that's what happens when believers let their STAs run rampant. They become miserable. And whether it is anger, violence, bitterness, hatred, lust, pride, greed, self-pity, whatever, implacability, pick the sin. It doesn't make any difference. If the believer allows it to dominate, then the believer's going to be miserable. And one of the things we see here very clearly in Jonah, I think, is a miserable believer. A believer that's not happy with his existence. A believer that, is, in a sense, at odds with God. And that becomes very clear when we get into chapter 4, that Jonah's issue is with God. And he is going to tell God so, in fact, which is, again, one step in the right direction is at least acknowledging that your issue is with God. However, that doesn't mean that you've repented of it or that you've changed your mind about it or any other thing, that you've dealt with it. It's just an acknowledgement simply of that. So verse 1 here, and again, Jonah recounts this, and the chronology of this jumps back and forth a little bit. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish. And this clearly places Jonah now, after having been cast overboard, inside the fish. So he's already been swallowed. How long he's in the fish, we are not told. Does he pray immediately? I don't know. I don't think he does immediately. Certainly he didn't when he was cast overboard. So how long he's in the fish before he prays, we're not told. And he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. The calling out of it in his distress, of course, would have occurred inside the fish. The he answered me didn't occur until the fish vomited him out on the beach, till he was safe, till the deliverance was accomplished. And you have here, again, an example of synonymous parallelism where I called out out of my distress to the Lord. I cried for help is parallel with I cried for help from the depth of Sheol. And Sheol here, it should be understood as nothing more than death or the grave. That Jonah recognized, essentially, I am a dead man. It does not mean that he went to the place of the departed dead. Now, some less than sound exegetes, J. Vernon McGee for one, says this means that Jonah died. No, it doesn't. It absolutely, you cannot prove that. Sheol is used so many ways, or at least three or four different ways, in the Old Testament that you cannot say he died and he went to the place of the dead and then God raised him from the dead. Well, if he did, then he's not a type of Christ. You know, he has been resurrected. So if he died, not resurrected, I guess, in the sense that he got a resurrection body, but certainly one would say he had to have been resuscitated. But I don't see that. Because when he said, when he called out of his distress, that means he's conscious. I cried from the depth of Sheol. Once you're dead and you're in Sheol, that's pretty much it. There are a few examples in the Bible, of course, of people that were resuscitated, but not very many. And and generally, when that happens, now maybe exclusively, I'd have to think through all the examples, but maybe exclusively when that happens, it's always associated with another person. Nobody ever just dies and goes to Sheol and comes back on their own. Somebody's involved in their resuscitation. Elijah resuscitated that widow's son there. Paul resuscitated that guy that fell out of the window dead. Dead when he landed. It wasn't the fall that killed him as much as the sudden stop. And then Jesus resuscitated Lazarus, as we know. But these were all done by other people. There's no... If Jonah died... First, this circumstance would be unique to the Bible as far as I understand it, and unique within the Bible even. So I don't think Jonah died. I think he uses Sheol here as a sense, and I had one foot in the grave. I was as good as dead. And he answered me is parallel with the fourth phrase there, you heard my voice. But again, Jonah wouldn't have known that until after the fact, till the deliverance was accomplished. Okay, we're ready to move on now with verse 3. For you had cast me into the deep. Into the heart of the seas. Verse 3 here, and you had cast is actually a wow consecutive plus the hiphil imperfect of shalak. S-H-A-L-A-K. This is the causative stem, actually, but it's only used in the hiphil and hophil, so this verb we might say is deponent in that sense. It's active, even though it is passive in form or causative in form. It's not you caused to have me cast. That's where, again, some people, even people who know the languages, don't stop and recognize this, that when verbs are used only in the lesser stems, that it means something about them. That it may not mean that they're causative or passive. It may just still mean that they're active. And shalak, to cast or throw, can only really essentially be active in that sense. So you had thrown me, and here he lays it at the foot of God, his problem. Of course, he said he was willing to do it, right? So whose fault is it? It's not, you know. But he blames God here in sense in his prayers, or lays it at God's foot. You had cast me, into the deep. The feminine singular noun here, metsola, is only used 12 times. M-E-T-S-O-L-A-H. This means depths or the deepest part of something. Into the heart, we might even say into the bottom, because that's what he's talking about here in context. When he's talking about the depths, he's talking about how far he went down. Into the heart, inseparable preposition bait plus the word levav, which means heart of the seas. Obviously, heart used figuratively here, not in a literal sense. The sea doesn't have a heart. Of the seas is yam, the word used all throughout this. Masculine plural noun, seas. And the current engulfed me. What you've got here is a wow plus, into the deep. Into the heart of the seas. Then you have a wow plus this word, nahar, literally a river or stream, is what the word means. Here refers to the currents of the ocean. They translated here, and the current which is a good way to put it, because we know that there are, you know, there are, quote, current river currents in the sea. The Gulf Stream, for instance, would be called a stream. We're familiar with that. And the current, and then you've got a poel imperfect, third masculine singular with a first person singular suffix of sabhav. S-A-B-H-A-B-H. That word literally means to turn around. And the idea here is the currents were spinning him around. For that sense, I mean, it was like he was in a giant, God's giant washing machine. But do you think this will clean Jonah up? The answer is no. No, it will not clean him up. Until Jonah changes his mind and does something for himself, this is going to continue to fester and be a problem in his life. So all the currents essentially were spinning me around. All your breakers and billows passed over me. All is a masculine singular now. Now clearly he's back up, and of course in time, as you can tell, from the time when he was in the whale praying to what happened immediately following his being cast overboard before the whale swallowed him. So now he's back in the water, we might say. This is previous time to what we had in the first two verses. All is the masculine singular noun construct of kol, all, each, or every. All your breakers, this word is mishbar, M-I-S-H-B-A-R, used eight times, literally a breaking or a breach. And in this sense, not a breaking through something or coming through something, but waves breaking over top of him. And all your breakers and your billows. You've got a wow plus the masculine plural noun construct of gal, G-A-L. This is derived from the verb for heaping or piling something up. So obviously, you know, like you could pile up grain or pile things up, leaves into a pile and all of that. Well, here it's viewed as waters being piled up. We would talk about high waves then, that the waters are piled up over me, literally. Over me is the preposition ale on top of. This is, gives you the spatial sense of this word. And then the verb passed over is actually the cal perfect, third person plural of avar. A-B-H-A-R. And that means exactly that. To pass over or pass through something. It's used of traveling through one place into another. So I thought, I have been expelled from your sight, and I will never see your holy temple again. I want to change the translation here for a couple of reasons. I think the New American Standard has missed the point of what he's saying here. They've gone with a more literal translation, but in context, they need to stop and think about it, I think. So I thought, I have been expelled from your sight. And, literally so is the way they translated the wow. I is the preposition, or the pronoun ani, A-N-I-Y, and this is I myself. So this is actually when the Hebrew verb contains the person in it. So when a discrete pronoun is used, this is designed to emphasize it. I myself was thinking, we might say. But in this case, it's a past tense, but so thought is fine. Cal perfect, first person singular of Amer. Now, this is actually the verb to say. But clearly, if you're underwater, you're not talking. This is only going on in Jonah's head. So they have rightly caught on here in the New American Standard that Amer is to be understood as thought. So I thought Niphal imperfect, or Niphal perfect here of Garash. G-A-R-A-S-H. That word means to expose publicly, to drive someone away, to execute an effective separation. Because it is niphal, because it is a passive, I have been expelled is the way they've translated it here. I have been separated from your sight. Preposition men. But wait a minute, isn't this what Jonah wanted? Wasn't he fleeing from the presence of the Lord? Now he's got what he wants. Now do you think Jonah's happy? I don't think he's happy. I don't think he's happy at all. From your sight is from the presence of your eyes, from before your eyes, literally. Neged, N-E-G-E-G-H-E-D-H. Neged means to be in front of, before, as I'm before you. And then the common dual noun construct, eyes, ayin, with the second masculine singular suffix. I have been expelled from your sight. Surely, You've got the adverb here, surely, and this is what I think is what through the New American Standard Translator, because many times this word "ach" is translated "nevertheless" or "however." But in this case, I think it's just really viewed here for emphasis. Surely, I will add. Literally, I'm going to give you the literal Hebrew of all this. I will add to see to your temple of holiness. And that's sort of the gist of it. I will add, hifil imperfect, first person singular of Yasaph. Y-A-S-A-P-H. This word means to add, to continue to do something, or to do something again. Halot suggests that when it is followed by an infinitive with a prefix lamed, which it is here, that it means to continue. So this is what you've got here is the I will continue, it would appear to say, to look towards your holy temple. Well, verse number one, this one can only be figurative at best anyway, because he's not looking towards anything. If he's underwater, he doesn't even have any clue which Jerusalem is. And the only thing he would know is up from down, maybe. And maybe he wouldn't even know that, depending upon how dire his situation is. And so, but he does recognize that God has effectively driven him out of his sight. So you got the prefix lamed here, which follows it with the hifil infinitive construct. To look at or to see, this word is nabat. N-A-B-A-T. To pay attention to. To, and then you've got kind of a redundant preposition here, L, to or towards, and then the word hekal, H-E-Y-K-H-A-K-H-A-L. That word means temple or palace, and then you got the masculine singular noun of kodesh with the second masculine singular suffix. The palace of your holiness, your holy temple, is the way they have called, they have translated here. And I will show you in the exposition as to why. I think what he's saying here is, again, I've been expelled from your sight and I'm never going to see your temple again. Because that makes more sense than I'm going to continue to look to your temple. Some here want to see a modicum of hope in this. And so I think that influences their translation here. That they want to see Jonah here seeking to recover. I don't see it. And we'll show you as we get into this. So point one. Jonah now begins to provide the details of his ordeal, focusing first on what he was thinking about prior to offering his prayer from the belly of the great fish. And again, I'm going to use belly all through here because it's inner parts. Again, the term is not technical, but assuming he got into the stomach, we don't really know for sure. He could have been lodged somewhere within the great fish. It doesn't matter. Wherever he was, it's still miraculous that he survived it. And that's so a bit all through here. I'll go with the traditional terms to explain this. Although typically I don't use whale or very often, you know, but most of the good translations don't. They use fish. So too, it is not unusual in the Hebrew style of writing for the author to provide a summary statement of his subject and then to fill in the details. In fact, if you don't understand that, when you read the book of Genesis, you will make some pretty serious exegetical blunders. Because it is very common for Hebrew style, the Hebrew style of writing, to give you an explanation, sort of what they're going to talk about, and then to talk about it. And that is not uncommon at all. Three, Jonah introduces his explanation of the circumstances that followed his expulsion with the ship with a simple wow here, which has the force of a causal conjunction. Here it's almost parallel to key. Four, you had cast me into the deep. He's back up to explain here. For one important feature about the prayer of Jonah, which he will not officially pray until verse 7, is his recognition of the fact that God is the active agent behind his plight. Five, while out of fellowship, while one out of fellowship often sits around and blames those around him for his failures and misery, Jonah does not blame the crew or any human agent for his current predicament. And that is, of course, one of the signs, both of human maturity and spiritual maturity, is that your people have to be responsible for their own actions. We do not, in that regard, cut people a whole lot of slack. If you did it, own up to it. It's your deal. It's not mine. I didn't do it. You did it. If I do it, I have to take responsibility for it. If you're wrong, you have to say you're wrong. You know, it's the way it's supposed to be. That's a part of normal human responsibility, of being a person that takes responsibility for their own actions. Here, Jonah doesn't blame the crew. He does blame God, though. Or at least he lays it at God's feet. Is there an element in this where Jonah is blaming God? There could be. I couldn't tell you fully from this. But I know when we get into chapter 4, it's real clear that he's busy blaming God there. And he sought to get away from God in the earlier part of the book. We know that. So does he blame God for what happens here? Well, he certainly knows God is behind it. So 6, also one should note that there is no attempt to assign any blame to himself for his circumstances. Wait a minute, Jonah. Aren't you at least partially in this mess because of your own actions? Or entirely in this mess because of your own actions? And actions have consequences. Jonah's circumstances are his own fault. Whether he ever acknowledges it or not, it's really irrelevant. It's still a fact. And Jonah needs to come to grips with this. But Jonah's not, at this point, inclined to come to grips with anything, I don't think. I think Jonah has allowed his irrational hatred of the Assyrians to consume him, and his STA dominates him at this point, even in this case where God's going to deliver him. Now, this is the big story behind Jonah. Here's this idiot dominated by his STA who deserves to die. And yet God delivers him. And yet he's pissed off when God does it for somebody else. Now that is about as bad off as you can get. That is as self-righteous as you can get, I think. That you deserve to die and God saves you, but then when he does it for somebody else, it angers you. Well, that is a sign of a great immaturity and great stupidity at that level. I'm not saying Jonah wasn't a more mature believer. He might have been, but this section of his life does not set well with him at all and doesn't come across very well for him. Well, one should note, again, there is no attempt to assign any blame to himself for his circumstances. Dear God, I deserve this. I know I've been an idiot. I shouldn't have run. None of these words are here. You're not going to find them in this prayer because I don't think Jonah thought that. I think Jonah just thought, well, God probably delivered me because I deserve it. Because I'm a great believer and this is it. Well, one should also note any confession of fault is missing from his prayer. The word for confess or admit or any of that is not a part of the vocabulary of this chapter. And people that don't confess their faults, admit that they're wrong and do these types of things, demonstrate that they've got some real mental attitude problems. 7, he attributes the actions to God himself, which demonstrates his recognition that God was actively engineering the circumstances in which Jonah now found himself. So 8, although Jonah has recognized that he is under severe divine discipline, I don't know that it gets much worse than this, you know, going to drown and being swallowed by a fish. That's a pretty bad way to go. This does not mean that he was willing, at least at this point, to admit his wrong and go to Nineveh as he had been instructed. And 9, in fact, Jonah does not ever fulfill this commission willingly. He must be given an additional command, and even then he doesn't have any desire to comply. Well, 10, nevertheless, he will comply. That part we will see. He will actually go through and obey here. Once God does to any believer what he has done to Jonah, it may cause that believer to rethink his position. And one would hope it would. I mean, the purpose of divine discipline, as we know, is to be remedial. It is to teach. Same way when a parent disciplines you as a child. It was designed to teach you certain things. When Hymenaeus and Alexander were rejected there from the local assembly, even Paul then said, while it was discipline, Paul said it was remedial so that they might learn not to blaspheme. And so God gives divine discipline, Hebrews 12 there. It says our fathers instructed us as was good to them, as it seemed good to them. They did the best they could. And we respected them. Well, shouldn't we much rather respect God's discipline when he levels it against us? One of the things you have to know under divine discipline, there are two responses to it. There's the soul-feigning response. Oh, God, this is horrible. I'm the worst believer ever. Nobody's worse than me. I can never recover. Woe is me response. And then there's the taking it lightly response. Oh, that's no big deal. God didn't mean anything by that. Yeah, he did. So those are the two extremes, the soul fainting and the I don't care. Both are wrong. The correct response to divine discipline is to take it to heart and admit that, okay, yes, I deserve this. When God disciplines me, I know for a fact, in my right mind, that I brought it on myself. I deserved it. I didn't. Nobody else did it. I did it. And if I'm under discipline, I'm under discipline. And you better be willing to admit that and to own up to it and say, okay, all right, this is the way it is. So, again, we will see in chapter 3:1 that he does comply. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, go. In verse 3, so Jonah arose and went to Nineveh. So, in this case, he does comply. Now, is he complying willingly? Is he in fellowship? Oh, absolutely not. No way. He's not complying well. My imagination is he's got 20 to 25 days of travel, and you can just hear him on the road all along the way. Why am I having to do this? God, hate God. What's he doing? I hate the Ninevites. I wish they were dead. I know God's sending me there because they're probably going to repent. That makes me mad too. And, you know, here's Jonah. That's Jonah, I think. I think that's absolutely Jonah. And then he gets so much into his anger, as we're going to see. He lets his anger so dominate him that he finally just gives into self-pity and depression. And then he's just, oh God, I want to die. I want to die. I want to die. Now he's not even angry. Now he just gives up. Well, that's not, to me, the mark of a believer really walking in fellowship consistently at all. So 10, nevertheless, he will comply. So again, once God's done to a believer what he's done to Jonah, I mean, seriously, if God did this to me, I would really be thinking my next step pretty carefully. And especially if God came back and said, okay, I want you to do this and such, same command he had given me before. I don't see Jonah jumping up to run off to Tarshish this time, I can tell you that. He has done figured he can't get away from God. And that's the big story in this book for Jonah, is you can't get away from God. It's fruitless to even try. And this is taught in other passages in the Psalms, for instance. Where shall I flee and you not find me? If I go to the ends of the morning, if I'm there at dawn, you're there. If I go to the farthest ends of the east, to the west, to the north, to the south, to the depths of the sea, to the heights of the mountains, even to the third heaven, to the depths of Sheol, you're there. A recognition of God's omnipresence. So 11, even so, it does not mean that the believer is mentally oriented to God's will. It may simply mean that he's been scared to death by the frightening power of God. Hebrews 10:31 gives us a little warning. All believers, in fact, not just us, but all believers, the author to the Hebrews, wanted to point this out so that his readers would take it to heart. And we're all too keenly aware, or should be, hopefully, we're aware, that God's going to judge all unbelievers. We know he's going to judge all unbelievers at the great white throne and cast them into the lake of fire. Well, he's going to judge all believers too. And if Peter's right, now it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. He's going to start with his people first. And we certainly see that in terms of the chronology of judgments, in that the Bema Seat occurs long before, 1,007 years or so, before the great white throne judgment. And even the judgment of believers there at their resurrection, I assume that's when they're judged, the Old Testament crowd, that occurs just after the second advent. So they're judged. So God judges all his people before he even judges all the unbelievers. This tells you, of course, that God is a good parent. And so verse 30, for we know him who said, vengeance is mine. I will repay, and again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And so again, fear of God is the appropriate response for the believer. 12, when one considers the book of Jonah in its entirety, it becomes apparent that Jonah really never adopted the proper mental attitude about his mission. So 13, therefore it would appear that Jonah is completely out of fellowship from the time that God gives him the commission to go to Nineveh, and I mean the first commission back in chapter 1. There's no evidence that he ever gets on top of this. So can a believer go weeks, months out of fellowship, acting like an idiot? Oh, you bet. Sure. David did it for almost a year over Bathsheba. Now why David wouldn't confess that, I don't know. But he wouldn't. He just said, he dug his heels in, I'm not going to deal with this. And ignored it, and God slowly but surely was killing him. just day by day by day. And David was probably within a week or two of actually being taken out. And finally, he deals with it. Finally. Now, what caused him to deal with it? I don't know. We're not really told. But a year's worth of discipline might get your attention. So, can people do all this? Oh, absolutely. It's not a wise thing to do. That's why we counsel you. Keep short accounts. Rebound. Deal with the sin. Acknowledge it for what it is. Don't rationalize it. Don't say it's okay. Don't say everybody does it. Deal with your sin before God. And so, from what I understand, if his mental attitude isn't right and he isn't doing it with the right motivation, he's not in fellowship. But this is a really great example when you look at this. Look at the lengths to which God will go to harvest positive volition. Even the obnoxious and stupid Jonah, who doesn't want to be there, who resents God, and we're going to find out the level of his resentment in chapter 4 because he's going to vocalize it. He's basically going to tell God, I knew you would do this because you're such an idiot. And you think, well, no one should talk to God that way. Well, Jonah did. Jonah adopted the I told you so attitude with God. I told you, God. You idiot, you didn't know. I told you this would happen. And so Jonah's quite the character, obviously. But guess what? Even the failures of Jonah does not stop the plan of God. And could God have used, again, another prophet? Sure he could have. Why doesn't he? Because he's working on Jonah as much as he's working on the Ninevites. Jonah needs this lesson as well as they do. So 14, this would also include the time he was praying. Therefore, for one to argue that Jonah was in fellowship because he prayed is wrong on several fronts. A, any suggestion that a believer is in fellowship because he is praying is simply wrong. Believers can pray out of fellowship, just as unbelievers. All unbelievers pray. Well, some of them, not all of them. But when they pray, I guarantee you they're out of fellowship. All unbelievers do it. And when they do pray, this manifests to me a very uninformed view of reality. B, there is little doubt that believers can, do, and have prayed out of fellowship. I see this in the life of Paul there when the Holy Spirit told him not to go to Jerusalem and he continues on this foolhardy quest that the Holy Spirit has said, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And Paul sets on and he keeps going. I don't doubt that he wasn't praying during that time. But does that prove he was in fellowship? I don't think so. He's in active disobedience to the will of God at that time. He hasn't dealt with it. He thinks he's smarter than God. That's a pretty dangerous situation to be in. Well, see, the most logical understanding here is that Jonah now calls on his God because he's scared to death of dying. So will people cry out to God when they're facing death, staring face to face? Yeah, sure. Does that mean they're in fellowship? No, not necessarily. If they haven't dealt with the underlying problem, they're not. So if his prayer is motivated by nothing more than fear, and he has not dealt with his failure before God via rebound, he's not in fellowship. So again, people see him recovering in chapter 1. I don't. People see him recovering here because he's praying? I don't. Because I think people can pray out of fellowship. I think that manifests a pretty low view, a low view of reality to say that. So I don't see at all that Jonah's recovered here. Jonah's going to be out of fellowship, it appears, for this entire book. Again, 2 months out of his life, completely out of fellowship, out of sorts with God. Does it happen? Yes, even to great believers. Apparently so. And this ought to be an encouragement to us. How stupid can we be? Oh, pretty stupid. Can we be as stupid as Jonah? Yeah, probably. And so why are these things written? For our encouragement, upon whom the ends of the age have come. So 16, therefore, when God delivers Jonah from the belly of the fish, it is not to be attributed to any action on Jonah's part or because he was in fellowship. God's deliverance is an object lesson to Jonah about God's grace. But you know what? That God's grace doesn't set well with Jonah. It doesn't set badly with Jonah when he gets it. What sets badly with him is when other people get it, particularly people he despised. So 17, does this great manifestation of God's grace cause Jonah to pull in his spiritual horns and extend the same grace to the Ninevites? No, not at all. No, in fact, Jonah doesn't appear to get it. So can believers go through all of this and still not even get it? Yeah, apparently. I mean, I'm not saying Jonah never got it down the road. Maybe this lesson finally, you know, dawned on him one day. He finally figured out, I see what God was doing there now. I'm sure he gets it now. He's in heaven. But, you know, in time, did he get it? I don't know. He didn't get it in this book, I can tell you that. So 18 verse 3 provides a graphic description of the events after Jonah was cast overboard. 19, he acknowledges that God had cast him into the deep, which is amplified by the phrase that follows, into the heart of the seas. 20, the term sea is often used in the plural and often translated by the New American Standard as a singular. Therefore, there is no theological significance to the plural form. We know where he is. He's in the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, we know where he's at. And that's not multiple seas there. It's just a sea. So, again, the fact that some interpreters, they see a singular or plural, and they want to make intense theological points out of this. It's not that big a deal. We talk about the seas, and we don't, you know, people talk about the Gulf of Mexico, and they call it a sea or an ocean. It's hard for me just not to correct them every time, but I've learned to bite my tongue. I want to go down and play in the ocean. Well, you're on the wrong coast. The Atlantic's on the other side. You're going to have to go that way, east, quite some ways, you know, across the peninsula. You know, or you can go south, you can get down, you know, to Key West and all that. So get it? So people use these kind of terms all the time. They use it in some ways indiscriminately. We know that. And so I don't read anything into this because he says sees that there's some great deep theological meaning here. 21, the next phrase is literally translated as a river was encircling me. This is Jonah's way of saying that the currents and tidal forces in the sea were tossing him around like he was in a washing machine. 22, he was effectively at the mercy of the tides and currents which trapped him and moved him in every direction. And in whatever direction God wanted him moved, he was moved. And he had no control over this. He's completely lost control of the situation. And again, at this point, does he say, oh, I'm wrong. God, this is horrible. No, not yet. Nope, he's got to be beat down a little more. So God's willing to put the beat down on him if he doesn't pull in his horns. And he's not done with him yet. That is the nature of having a fear of God. God will put the beat down on you and you won't like it. I don't like it when he puts it on me. So I can guarantee you, you won't like it. I see what he did with Jonah here, and nobody in their right mind would wish this on anybody. So 23, the final section of verse 3, deals with the fact that although the sea had become relatively calm, the waves were still overwhelming Jonah. Now, it had become certainly calm enough that the sailors took it as a miracle. But again, how long Jonah stayed above water is debatable, given, I think, that he would have been fully dressed. And, you know, whatever all he had with him, which may not have been much, was probably cast overboard with him as well. So for him, as the waves, they don't have to be very high. Let's assume they're only 3-foot waves. Well, the sailor would assume a 3-foot wave was a calm sea. But if you're out there in 3-foot waves and they're washing over you consistently, you don't necessarily think it's so great. And they might have even thought 5 or 6-foot seas were relatively calm if they were out, you know, pretty far out on a boat. But those are definitely more than you want to deal with if you're in the water, for those to come crashing over you repeatedly. So, although the sea had become calm, the waves were still overwhelming Jonah. 24, this is graphically expressed by the Hebrew gal, which refers to that which is heaped or piled up. 25, the term is used in several ways which have significance here in Jonah. A, it is used of things piled up as a form of witness. Genesis 31, 46-48. Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones and they made a heap and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegar Sa Hadutha, but Jonah called it Galeed, and that is from Gal, that means the heap or the witness. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore it was named Galeed. Laban's name didn't stick, Jacob's did. So that is used there. B, the waves are effectively God's witness against Jonah. And C, it is used of piling up stones on a burial plot. Joshua 7:26, there in the story about Achan. Joshua 7:26. They raised up over him a great heap of stones that stand to this day. And there the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor. That's the Valley of Trouble. Why? Because the guy there, Achan, was troubling Israel. He had troubled Israel. So D, Jonah is effectively buried in the sea. So 26, the final phrase of verse 3 indicates that Jonah has now been overwhelmed by the waters, which have covered him completely. And 27, as Jonah begins to sink beneath the waves, his thoughts move to the apparent reality that God has officially abandoned him. And that's really not what you want as a believer. You really don't want God saying, leave him alone. I'll abandon him. But Jonah comes to this recognition. 28, although the verb amer, to speak or say, is used, it is apparent here that Jonah is not speaking to anyone. He is thinking these things to himself as he descends to his apparent death. You can look in the book of Ruth 4:4. It is not. Unparalleled here to have this sort of construction. Verse 4, so I thought to inform you. That word translating thought is actually amer, to say. I said to inform you. Say, buy it before. And so, you know, essentially what they're saying here is that what I thought ahead of time I did say out loud. But it is clearly just in the thinking stage at that time. And also 1 Samuel 20:26. So this construction, again, is not to be taken as too unique. There may have been more. I just cited a couple, but there may have been more times. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought. The word thought there is literally amer again, said. But we're clearly told in the preceding context he didn't speak out loud about it to anybody. So it clearly has to be just his thoughts. So again, this is not an unusual way for this to be used here. 29, ironically enough, Jonah now has what he has so desperately desired when he determined to flee from the presence of the Lord. He now officially feels rejected and abandoned by God. So he's got what he wants, right? Well, I would say, okay, you got what you want. You happy? No. Why is it when we get what we want all the time, it doesn't make us happy? And yeah, even temporarily sometimes, even for even a while. Well, 30, this becomes the plight of the believer that flees from God if he is ultimately positive. And that's a big if he's ultimately positive. If God ultimately has it as a part of his plan that this believer is going to make it because he reads his spiritual tape. And he knows that given the right circumstances, this believer could make it, much as Jonah is facing. God will engineer those circumstances. Ultimately, though, the desire to flee from God and the restrictive nature of the straight and narrow will be replaced with a conscious awareness of his absence. And that's not a fun consciousness awareness to have. God has done with me. God has abandoned me. God's finished with me. Well, as long as you're alive, clearly that's not ultimately the case. But essentially, as Jonas, he's alive, but really he's one step away from death. I mean, he's literally seconds or minutes away from dying. He's taking it right up to the death's door, literally, in this. Well, 31, the latter portion of verse 4 is somewhat more problematic. Most interpreters simply take this verse as the New American Standard has rendered it as an expression of hope for the future. And 32, this is largely based on the understanding of the adverb at, which can be used in a few different ways. It can be used with an affirmative emphasis. And is translated as surely or certainly. Genesis 26:9 is one of the passages in which it is used that way. Then Abimelech, now again, when you if you read the book of Genesis, recognize that when you see this term Abimelech, Abimelech may be a title or it may be his name. Most likely it's a title because the word really just means my father was king. So it's, you know, it's a, somebody who assumed the throne out of a royal lineage. It would appear to be more of a title than a name, but that's fine. It doesn't, not that it materially affects the story. But when reading the Bible, some people don't know that, and so they think, well, Abimelech was his name. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, and it may have been his name, by the way. He may have just used that name as a way of saying, hey, I'm in the royal line. It could have very well been. Behold, Ach, he uses here, certainly she is your wife. So here it's an absolute emphatic sort of usage there of surely or certainly. Be it can be used as an emphatic restrictive, and it would be translated only. Like Genesis 7:23, we see it used there. And here it's quite restrictive because it's dealing with the destruction of the entire planet. Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land. From man to animals to creeping things to the birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth. And Ach, only Noah, was left together with those that were in the ark. So here it's they've done a very good job with it here in that it is emphatically restrictive. And see, it can be translated in an antithetic sense and is used, and you can also see 9:4, that's another one there of only, and is translated as yet or nevertheless. Jeremiah 34:4. So, here it's translated yet. Yet hear the word of the Lord. Basically, or nevertheless, hear the word of the Lord, in spite of what you're already thinking and saying and what your beliefs already are. In this case, it is used to point out that your belief system is wrong, and I'm going to give you the skinny on it. Okay, well, our time is up. Let's go ahead and stop there, and we will continue on here, wrap this up in our second session. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break.